50 from Alexandria.
Thank you, Gary. My name is David Duncan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey
everybody. Thank you, Billy and Blue Ridge Speakers Group, for doing this event and for asking me to come and be a part of it. Very special. Been coming out to Blue Ridge Speakers Group for quite a few years now. Billy and I have known each other for quite a few years. Outstanding man, outstanding member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and an outstanding group, really vibrant, active group, the Blue Ridge Speakers Group. And this is a great event. I have never had occasion to make it out here to this event, so I'm really excited to be here. And but I was told about it. Jose said, you know, the food is great, so, you know, come on out. Even though I'm speaking, he came on out, and some guys from my group came out with me, and get to see some old friends. And Ross is here, Ross B., doing the taping. Love you, Ross. Ross told me a long time ago the difference between a good meeting and a great meeting is whether or not he gets mentioned. So, it's going to be a great meeting now, you know. And I just got to meet Shannon. I'm looking forward to hearing your story, Shannon, and my buddy Rich. It's been a while since we've seen each other, and look forward to getting to spend some time with you. And I thank all of you for being here. I had a sponsor who straightened me out early on. He said, David, let me explain something to you. I don't know how he knew what I was thinking, but he said, let me explain something to you. He said, you need AA a lot more than AA needs you. Because I was wondering. And I understand that today, you know, because, if I hadn't made it, if I got caught in traffic or slept in or whatever and hadn't shown up, there's, you know, any one of you guys could have got up here and gave a talk this morning and you guys would have had a meeting. But if none of you had shown up, I'd have driven 2 hours out here to talk to an empty room and I wouldn't have got a meeting. So I need AA a lot more than AA needs me. Billy also told me that last year my good friend Dave D. from Baltimore was the kickoff speaker here, a very dear friend of mine. Got a story about him. A couple of years ago, I was at a meeting. There's a big Sunday night meeting up there called Midtown, and I was at Midtown, and I was walking out with a friend, and this kid runs up to me and goes, are you Dave D.? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, I have got to get you to speak at my meeting. Will you give me your number? Can I call you? Can I book you to speak at my meeting? I said, of course. And I started giving my number, 703-615, and he goes, you still live in Baltimore, right? No, but I can give you his number if you would like it. That's my ego deflation at depth story. I still need it. I'm sorry, I think it's allergies, whatever it is. I've had this, my voice is a little bit gravelly and a little bit of a cough because of allergies, so hopefully I'm going to make it through this without abusing you guys with that. I do have a sobriety date. It's January 24th, 1989. For that, I am truly grateful. I don't take any credit for it whatsoever. What it really means is I have now officially been sober 25 and a half years longer than I meant to be. I have a home group. It's Hope Is Here in Old Town Alexandria. Tuesday nights, 8:30. Standard drunk time. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other men. And I certainly did not come to AA and sign up for the 26-year plan. You know, I was, as a matter of fact, I went an alcoholic when I got to AA. Apparently, you become an alcoholic by going to too many AA meetings, because I wasn't one when I got here, but I have a severe case of alcoholism now. I wasn't looking for the no drinking plan. I was looking for the drinking and no bad stuff plan. If you had one of those, I could just drink and get rid of all the bad stuff happening to me, I would have paid to belong to that, you know, but I wasn't really looking for the no. You guys scared me when I got here. Because you said things like, if you follow this way of life, you'll never have to drink again. And I thought, oh, my God. My God, they're, like, serious. You know? It was scary stuff to me. I was talking to Shannon, and she said, oh, I see all these kids who, you know, get sober young. I was 20 years old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me tell you, everybody would go, oh, you're so lucky. You're so lucky you got here young. I did not feel lucky when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. That is not exactly what I was feeling. The only thing more uncool than being a member of AA when you're 20 years old is being a sober member of AA, you know? not, I, God bless them, you know, I hear some people say that they came to AA and, you know, they finally felt like they were home, like they belonged, like they'd found the place where, you know, they belonged. And God bless you if that's your story, you know, but I walked in going, oh God, please, not this, not this, anything but this, you know, don't. I was telling somebody a couple of weeks ago, like, I literally looked at AA as punishment. This was my punishment. I had my fun, even though it wasn't fun anymore. I had had my fun, and now I had to take my medicine. I looked at this as medicine or punishment, and I'm here to tell you, because Rich and I were laughing about it before the meeting. Like, our lives are so incredibly full and so rich and such a wonderful story. I love my life. I love my story. I hope if you're here today and you're like I was when I came in, which was, I didn't want what I came in because I didn't want what I had. Not because I was convinced that I wanted what you had, but I knew I want what I had, you know. And one day I hope you stay long enough and you move your feet a little bit, and I hope one day you wake up and what you have is exactly what you want, you know, because it's a beautiful, beautiful experience. It's a full, rich, abundant, amazing story. My life is, your life is, everybody's life can be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard somebody say this, and I found it true. You know, alcoholics are, we're one of the only class of people in the world who get to live two completely different lives in one lifetime. And that's been, I have been fortunate by God's grace or luck or fate or whatever you want to call it. I have been fortunate enough to live two completely different lives in one single lifetime. So, I always think that drinking deserves an honorable mention in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank, just in case you were wondering. Lots of people have reasons for why they're alcoholic. Divorces, military families, trauma, you know, bad things happening. I don't have any of that. I had the most normal childhood anyone could wish for, two wonderful parents. The only reason that I can find why I'm an alcoholic is I love booze. I love it. Love it, love it, love it. From the first time I got drunk, which was Bacardi 151 and Country Time Lemonade Mix at my friend Mike DeWatt's house, and they started passing, I was like 15 years old, and they started passing around this Tupperware bowl, and I started drinking it, and I got enough of that stuff in me to get the effect produced by alcohol. I had little sips off my brother's beer or whatever before nothing happened. I got enough of that stuff in me to get the effect produced by alcohol. And these constant companions that I had had ever since I can remember, you know, called fear, guilt, shame, insecurity, uncertainty, free-floating anxiety, if you want a technical term, all that, it went away. I knew peace for one of the first times. The way I describe it is, I didn't know how bad I felt until I felt that good, you know? But I'm drinking this, and I'm going, man, I felt really bad, because this is it. You know, that first night of drinking, nothing bad happened. The cops didn't show up. I didn't get arrested. I didn't go to the hospital. Nothing like that happened. But today I know that one thing for sure happened the first time I got drunk, and that was something got branded on my brain. And what got branded on my brain was, this works. Booze works. And a brand never comes out. And if I stay sober 5,433 years, that brand will still be on my brain. I am an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Left to my own devices, I will always go back to the thing that I knew worked for me once upon a time, a long time ago, and my brain is wired and programmed that way. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. So I just proceeded to do that as much and as often as I could, you know. And at the beginning of my drinking, I could afford to turn my nose up at stuff. You get over that. You know, I love Bacardi 151. I love, you know, grain alcohol. I love Southern Comfort. I love Jack Daniels. I love vodka. I love green shots. I love, Löwenbräu. I love Heineken's. I love Budweiser. I love warm Schaefer Light. I love Mad Dog 2020. I love Thunderbird. I love wine coolers in a can. You know, I mean, taste, you know, you can get over that. You know, you just keep drinking. I was an effect drinker. You know, my sponsor for 16 years said I wasn't a problem drinker. I was a solution drinker. You know, drinking wasn't a problem for me. Drinking was my solution, you know. And my drinking kind of went like, there was an old timer from Northern Virginia who used to say, When I started drinking, I had this much fun and I had this much trouble. And when I finished drinking, I had this much trouble and I had this much fun. And that's kind of about how it went. At first, I drank to feel good, and booze worked really, really well. It made me feel good, and it was fun, and it was adventurous. I had the sponsor that also said, Tom used to also say, you know, if you never had fun drinking, I feel bad for you. It's kind of like getting pregnant without having sex. Like, you missed the good part, you know? God, I miss Tom. And anyway, I drank to feel good, and booze worked really well. It made me feel good, and it was adventure, and it was fun, and it was with friends and doing things you're not supposed to do, going places you're not supposed to go, and it was exciting. And then as, you know, I began to lie and manipulate, do the things I needed to do to get a drink, and I was raised right with the difference between right and wrong. I wasn't raised by a pack of wolves, you know, and that little thing called guilt, you know, and shame started to come in. They're kind of like on the rent-to-own plan, you know? I mean, they don't like moving wholesale at once, you know? It's kind of like the girlfriend, you know, like just they have a drawer. And then you don't, they have the little dresser, and then they don't, and then you walk around one day and go, where's my stuff? You know? That's like my, the love of my life. My girlfriend moved in a year ago. That's exactly what happened. So a couple of weeks later, I was walking around like, where's my stuff? See, I was informed we're upgrading. Which, believe me, is the absolute truth. It was a major upgrade. So, anyway, as those things began to pile up, I drank to not feel bad, and booze worked really, really well. It took that away. It made me not feel bad. And the end of my drinking, the very best I could get out of the bottle was absolutely nothing. I drank for what we call oblivion. I drank for the blank spot. I drank to not feel, not think, not exist. Because the pain of sobriety was so great that that was infinitely preferable to living sober. Lack of power. Like I said, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. that's because I had a little definition problem when I came to AA. See, I would be talking to you, and you would say, do you think you're an alcoholic? What you meant when you said that was, do you think that you have a physical allergy, a phenomenon of craving, which once you start drinking makes it impossible for you to stop drinking, and is that coupled with a mental obsession, which means when you're not drinking, you can't stop thinking about how you're going to drink again? And if you ask me, do you think you're an alcoholic, I would say no. Because what I meant was, I've never drank out of a brown paper bag or slept in a box. That's what I meant when I said, no, I'm not an alcoholic. So I had a little definition problem. I had become an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that really... okay, I won't skip ahead. Anyway, I drank as long and as often as I could. I was I was a periodic drunk. I didn't drink a fifth a day for 50 years. Okay, I was a periodic. I would stay sober for a day, for a week, for a month. I'm almost sure that there was a month in there somewhere. I can't prove it, but I think there was a month in there somewhere. But I would always drink again, and every time I drank again, the same thing happened every time I drank. You know, I never tapered off of drinking. I always tapered on, which usually meant that I would go out and have a couple and take an inventory. Cops didn't show up. I didn't get fired. I didn't get kicked out of the house. We're good, you know, and then take off drinking. so I always tapered on, and I was this periodic kind of alcoholic. And everybody thinks that they're the worst kind of alcoholic. I think that I'm the worst kind of alcoholic because I am the alcoholic that stays sober just long enough to give you hope. Just long enough to give the people who love me hope. Maybe this time he means it. Maybe this time he's serious. Maybe this time he's going to make it. And then you know what I do? I drink. I drink. I get sober, and I'm sober for a period of time, and everybody else is happy that I'm sober, except me, right? Everybody else, you know, you just show up to work when you're supposed to show up, and you be where you say you're going to be, and, you know, you don't lose the car, and you puke on people and make drunken amends and all that. And everybody else gets real comfortable and real happy, except for me. I want to kill everybody. For me, the difference between a drinking drunk and a not drinking drunk is suicide and homicide. I mean, I'm like about to, you know, and then I would drink. And And I would get drunk, and I would screw everything up. And when you do that, like the people, the non-alcoholics, like they need a reason, they need explanations. You know, they need a reason for why did you do that? And they're asking me, why did you screw everything up again? And if you really press me for a reason, I'll give you a reason. It was usually, you know, my favorite, which was, well, it's you. You'd get off on my back if you had to deal with the family that I had to deal with, if you had to deal with the girl I had to deal with, if you had to deal with the stuff I had to deal with, then you'd be doing it too, and I'd have to make something up because I couldn't tell them the truth. Because the truth was, I don't know. But you can't tell them that. You know, I didn't mean to do it again. I didn't want to do it again, but I did it again. And I don't know why I did it again, but you can't tell them that. Because if you tell them that, they put you in an I love me jacket and send you off for observation. But you have to come up with a reason, so you tell them a reason. And then I tell them the reason, and I go, oh, that must be it. And I'm just doing myself to repeat the whole cycle over and over again, you know. When I got a sponsor, I've had sponsors almost the whole time that I've been sober, with very rare exception. When I finally listen to a sponsor, there's a difference, if you didn't know. I mentioned to him one day, I said, yep, I'm in denial. And he said, who told you that? Uh-oh. I said, you know, yeah, we're all in. Yes, this was you, Al. He said, yes, we're all in denial. And we're all in denial, right? And he said, no. He said, you're not in denial. I said, what am I? He said, you're delusional. I said, what's that? He said, psychotic thinking. That didn't sound as good as denial. I understand that today. The deal was, you know, when I was sober for those periods of time, you know, something would occur in my mind. Something would occur, and my mind would tell me, let's have a drink. It'll be okay this time. And the thing is, when my mind told me it would be okay this time, I mean, even in the light of a mountain of evidence, the trail of destruction that I had just left behind me, when my mind told me it'll be okay this time, I believed it. I was not a guy going, this is going to be a complete train wreck. Watch this. You know, I mean, I believed when my mind told me that lie. That is why I was delusional. I might still be delusional today. I infinitely prefer this delusion to the one that I had before I came to AA. But I was completely delusional because I didn't know the difference between the true and the false. Now, why couldn't I stay? My mom, my poor mom, she's not an alcoholic. I've seen her drink 3 times. She's not cut out for it. But she's a wonderful woman. But she asked me after I got sober, she's like, you would get sober for a little while every once in a while. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, why couldn't you just stay sober? And I said, you want to know what it was like getting sober? And she said, yeah. I said, hold your breath. She went, I said, now hold it for 30 days. That's what it was like. It was like holding my breath for 30 days is what not drinking was like to me. No wonder I was scared when I came here and you guys said, don't drink. What? I've already done that. I know that's not an answer. So my problem is not stopping. My problem is staying stopped. The best reason, description, whatever that I found, that I've heard, I ain't making any of this up. This is just the stuff that I've heard that I identify with, was this guy was describing alcoholism and the mental process and the way people think. And he said, everybody has background noise in their head. And in normal people's head, the background noise is like this. In an alcoholic's head, the background noise is like this. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, this thing is going on, which is why newcomers don't call until 2 o'clock in the morning. And I swear to God, about 3 or 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, get ready for your phones to ring when this thing is over, you know, because that's when my brain kicks in and starts working, you know, and I just want peace. I just want to go to bed. I want to get a good night's sleep. I want to get up and do the right thing. And I lay my head down on the pillow and my mind goes, hey! We can't go to sleep. We got to figure this out. What are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about that? This is going to happen. That's going to happen. You know what booze did for me? Turned off the noise in my head. Turned off the noise in my head. Let me know a little bit of peace for a little bit of time. No wonder it was worth it. I don't think it does that for other people. Not the non-alcoholics that I've met. But it certainly does that for me. See? You know what AA does? Turns off the noise in my head. One day at a time. To the extent that I practice it, lets me know one day of peace. Up here, I'm right here 2 inches behind my belly button, and that's my gut check. That's my check on my spiritual condition. When I lay down at night, and there isn't a room full of people to talk to, there isn't a newcomer to work with, there isn't anybody to be on the phone with, there isn't any loved one to tell me how much they love me and how much they want to support me. When I lay my head down on the pillow at night, two people, me and God, what's going on 2 inches behind my belly button? That's my gut check. You know, most of the time, everything's okay. If it's not, I got somebody to talk to, and there's only one other person up, right? So anyway, what happened to me was I got in some trouble. People like me always get in trouble, and I was a tough guy, so when I got in trouble with the law, I did what tough guys do. I went home to Mom, and Mom hired a lawyer. And the lawyer took care of the legal problems, and my parents said, we know a couple that's a year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. They said they'd be willing to talk to you if you wanted to talk to them. And since my social calendar had cleared up, I said, and they were paying for the lawyer, and it seemed like the right thing to do, I said, okay. And I went and met John and Lisa, both of whom are still sober today. And they were both a year sober, and John was the first one there. Went to meet him at their house. John's the first one that was there. And my first impression of an AA member was he was smoking unfiltered Camel cigarettes and drinking black coffee. And I thought, this guy's getting well? Wow. So, so John started telling me his story. And the magic that happened that day was the magic that happened back in 1935. Is the magic that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic. And what John did, what was different about that day was up until that point, I had lots of people talk to me about my drinking. I had people who loved me talk to me about my drinking. I had people who were friends talk to me about my drinking. I had people who were ministers and counselors and teachers and parents talk to me about my drinking. But it was always about me. It was always, what are you going to do about your drinking? Dave, you need to do something about your drinking. Dave, when are you going to do something about your drinking? The problem was, if you had a problem with my drinking, you had a problem. You had a problem, you got a problem. Just leave me alone and let me do what I want to do. I ain't hurting nobody but me. Yeah, that's one of the biggest lies that I told myself. I found out different later on. If you at all still suffer from that delusion that you don't hurt anybody but you, I'll tell you what got me over it. Go down to Intergroup or Central Office or whatever you call it in this area and answer phones. That's what I did. I took calls from the mothers and the fathers and the sons and the daughters and the brothers and the sisters. Never again suffered from the delusion that I was the only one that I was hurting. But anyway, you got a problem with my drinking, you got a problem. Funny story. I was talking to the guy's anniversary over in D.C. and they had a wet drunk there. Love wet drunks in meetings. I mean, why are we having meetings if we can't have a wet drunk in a meeting, right? And they said them right up front. I got to that part and I said, if you had a problem with my drinking, you had a problem. Dude stands up and goes, yeah! He identified. So anyway, what happened that day was John took away my last best excuse, because my last best excuse always was, you don't understand. You don't know what it's like to be me. And here was a guy sitting in front of me. He wasn't telling me I was an alcoholic. He was telling me he was an alcoholic. And I knew, you know, he knew. Not only had he walked in my shoes, he'd gone a few miles further down the road, you know, and I could not look him in the eye and say, you don't understand what it's like to be me. At the end of that, he asked me three questions. He said, I hear you got a problem with booze. See, I like to have a beer every once in a while. He said, I hear you got a problem with drugs. I said, you know, I smoke a J every once in a while. You know? He said, tell me this, are you happy? You don't look happy. And I said, no, I don't even remember what happiness is. And he took me to some meetings. I'm not a big joiner. I'm not a big Kool-Aid drinker. Didn't pick up a white chip. Didn't admit to him. Didn't cop to anything. But I went to some meetings. What I remember about my first meetings was the laughter, because I realized it had been a long, long time since I'd laughed. Not like the laugh, you laugh when your boss tells a joke and you're supposed to laugh, or you're completely loaded with your buddies and you're laughing. I mean, just genuinely laughed, you know. There wasn't much funny going on in my life, you know, when I got here. It was very dark, very doom, everything. And so he said, maybe you want to go to some meetings. And he took me to some meetings. It took about 6 more months. And I was back in Charlottesville, back in school. My drinking was ramping up again. Put all the other party favors down. 6 months later, still drinking, ramping up. I'm back in the same place, the scene of the crime, that all the other stuff had happened. It's ramping up. I came home one day, I popped open a beer, drank half of that Coors all at once, and something occurred to me. And I can't call it an audible voice, but it was a thought so loud, it was undeniable, and it said, there's nothing different. And I knew what it meant. I call it a moment of clarity. I had that moment of clarity. Not that that was the first one I ever had, you know, but they're very fleeting. Those moments of clarity are very brief. And I had one that said, I'm about to head straight down the road that I just came from, and for once in my life, I didn't want to take the trip. And I didn't finish that beer. That was my last drink. I didn't know that that would be my last drink for the next 26 years. But that was my last drink. It was half a can of beer. Very undramatic. And an hour later, I was walking down the street, and I ran into a guy who's still sober today. A guy who I'd partied with the year before. He had disappeared. And if you ran with my group and you disappeared, it only meant one of three things. Either you went to jail, you went to treatment, or you were dead. And I would have known it if he went to jail or he was dead, so I made a quick deduction. He was passing by me. I grabbed him, and he said, Dave. I said, Philip. He said, Philip, are you in AA? And he said, yes. And I said, will you take me to a meeting? And he said, yeah, I'll take you to one tonight. I'll pick you up at 7:30. Where do you live, and what's your number? Ironically, he did not give me his number. I'll tell you what the significance of that is in a minute. So that was about 1:30 in the afternoon. Now, it's amazing what the alcoholic mind can do with 6 hours. Because at 1:30 in the afternoon, I was just scared enough to ask someone to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By 7:30 that evening, I had deduced that I had grossly overreacted to the situation. It's not that bad. And I swear to this day, if I had had his number, I would have called and made any excuse in the world. I got to paint my toenails. I got to walk the dog. I got to wash my hair. I said anything to get out of going to that AA meeting. But I didn't have his number, and he showed up, and he got me, and we went to Monday Night JPA, which I call my first meeting of AA. Three things happened at that meeting. I got a white chip, and I got a white chip because when they call for white chips, Philip went like this in my ribs, and so I got up and got a white chip. And what I said, there's still Randy's Randy here. There's still, no, Randy's not here today. There's still people sober in Charlottesville that can verify this. When I got my white chip, they asked me, I don't know if they were just bored or generous that day or whatever, but they asked me if I wanted to say something. Now, the people from my home group will tell you. I may not know much, but there's never been a time in my life that I didn't have something to say. So, Ross can attest to this. So when I got my white chip, I said, I am not an alcoholic. This is purely a precautionary measure. Just in case. And they said, keep coming back. I got a sponsor because Philip said, you see that guy over there? I said, yeah. He said, go ask him to be your sponsor. So you be my sponsor? He said, okay. He said, do you have a big book? I said, no. He said, do you have $5? I said, no. I lied. I didn't want to spend five. I don't want to be here. I don't want to spend $5 on this thing. So he bought me my first big book, and he took me to some meetings. My first 30 days, I went to meetings. I don't know how many meetings I went to. I wasn't counting them. I just went to some meetings because you don't really need to count them if you're not really an alcoholic, right? And I did the newcomer dance. I took 5 trips to the coffee pot, 3 cigarette breaks, figured out which girl I wanted to talk to afterwards, and did anything but pay attention because you don't really need to pay attention if you're not really an alcoholic, right? So 30 days later, I went to pick up my 30-day chip, and I picked it up, and I'll never forget, Big Tom H comes up, gives me a hug, and says, congratulations. And I looked him straight in the eye, and I said, I'm going to drink, which was news to me. Because, you know, they write a perfect description of me in the last chapter of the big book, where A Vision for You, where they talk about the boy whistling in the dark. You know, I feel, oh, this is great. I love sobriety, you know. I know everything is. I know where I was. I wake up on time. This is wonderful. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, like, oh my God, I haven't had a drink in 30 days. Like, I was so dry, I was a fire hazard. I needed a drink. I remember, I was kidding myself. I remember now, in those 30 days, going out to dinner with my girlfriend, and literally, she said, do you care if I order a beer? I said, do whatever you want. So she ordered a beer. That beer had the pull, gravitational pull of the sun. I literally sat on my hands if utensils were not in them, literally, to get through that dinner without grabbing that beer. So anyway, this was news to me, but all of a sudden I knew it was true. I was when I was out there, I was really bad at I was bad at a lot of things, but I was really good at two things. I was really good at just getting by. I mean, just barely getting by, like leave a little skin behind, but make it kind of getting by. And I was a champion plan comer upper with her. I mean, if you stick me in a jam, just feed me two beers and I can figure out a way out of it, right? So I'm always making plans. So I had a plan that night. The plan was to go get my 30-day chip at the AA meeting and meet the blonde at the keg party afterwards, right? And all of a sudden I knew I was not going to drink ginger ale, right? I needed to drink badly. Now, the next thing that came to mind was, if I'd have known this, I certainly wouldn't have told him, because now I'm going to have to sit here and sit through every AA slogan ever invented. I mean, there you go. Don't leave before the miracle happens, and, you know, you can do it, and you have too much to live for, and blah, blah, blah. And I thought I'd just puke on his shoes if he just recited this stuff to me. He didn't say any of that. He looked at me straight back in the eye, and he said, "No, you're not. You're coming with us." Not sure what step that is, but that's what he said. Actually, I do know now. We call that the shut up and get in the car step. And that night, I said the most profound, up to and including today, the most profound thing that I have ever said in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "Okay. Okay." And I blew off the blonde at the keg party, and I went with them. We went and got pizza, watched a couple movies. One of them dropped me off at home, and I went to bed. And when I woke up the next morning, I was still sober. And the reason I tell you that story is I've just told you the story of my recovery. That is, it didn't dawn on me then, but it only dawned on me a long time later. That was the first time in a long time that I put my plan aside, and I just followed what you guys were doing, and I stayed sober when I knew I was going to get drunk. And that is the story of my recovery. That's what my recovery has been all about. For in order for me to get this thing, not just put the plug in the jug, but in order for me to get this thing, what I had to do, what had to happen to me was, I had to run out of better ideas. I'm that guy. I always know better than everybody else. I always got a better plan. I always got a better way of doing it. Right? And I had to run out of better ideas. That's what had to happen. So, Now is the part where I'm supposed to say, and then my sponsor and I opened up the big book and I sat down and did the steps, but not quite. I know none of you are like this, but I'm kind of strange this way, that when I was out there and somebody said, "Here, Dave, drink this. It's amazing." I went, "Okay." They said, "Here, smoke one of these. This will feel great." And I went, "Okay." You know, but "Here, take some of these. What do those do?" "I don't know." "Okay." You know, I like that, you know, but I come here to AA and you guys say, "Get a home group, get a sponsor, do the steps." And I went, "Whoa, whoa, I don't want to rush into anything. Let's find out what this thing's about first before I, you know, make any commitments here." You know, it's weird, but that's exactly what I did, right? Rash decisions about the only kind of decision I've been making in my life up to that point. But all of a sudden, I'm going to err on the side of caution. So, for the next 3 years, I am living testament that everybody in AA is not getting well. Because I was one of them. The best way I can describe it is, girls, I was the one your sponsor points at and goes, "Stay away from him. Don't go near him." That was me. Not so much today. Progress, not perfection. But I was me. What do you get when you sober up a drunken horse thief? A sober horse thief. And I was me, with no booze and all my glory running around AA. I tried to fix my problem. I tried sports. I took up every sport known to man except high lie. Practiced my tennis serve an hour a day, ace racquetball player, joined a rugby team 3 hours a day in the gym, you know, all of this. I was in Olympic fitness, and it's crazy, absolutely crazy. I go to AA parties and start fights, and that's no lie. I did that, you know. Cheat. We play Trivial Pursuit. Cheat? Oh, my God. You know, my team always won, I'll put it that way, no matter what. I was crazy. I was nuts. So I said, okay, it's a spiritual program. So I went out and bought a 12-step Bible and read I and Thou by Martin Buber and Iron John and a bunch of deep stuff. Why? So I could come and I could tell you about spirituality and about God. Man, I could give you some heady stuff, you know? Sound great. And at the end of the meeting, I go get in the car and I go die because I was so lonely I couldn't stand it. You know, I was trying everything in my power to fix my problem. Here's what I found out. What I found out was, ironically, all my life, everybody had been telling me that my problem was alcohol, and alcohol was not my problem. My problem was something much more insidious than that. My problem was this little thing called alcoholism. And that's different than alcohol. You know what I used to treat my alcoholism? Alcohol. And it worked for a while. But then that became a problem. So I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I took away the alcohol. And guess what was there? Alcoholism. You know where alcoholism lives? Right there. Right on top of my shoulders. You know? It lives right on top of my shoulders, and that was what I was stuck with. I was stuck with me, and I didn't have a solution for it. So anyway, I'm 3 years sober. I'm trying all this stuff. I'm trying everything I can think of. And I can do a lot of things. The big book says this. I can do a lot of things in my life. I have a lot of abilities. I have a lot of stick-to-itiveness. You know, I hear some people say alcoholics are lazy people. You have never met anybody as industrious as an alcoholic. We are, however, very particular about what we put our energy into. And it's not always taking out the trash or mowing the lawn. But I got big ideas, and I, you know, sometimes I lack follow through. A couple years ago, I bought this townhouse, a big divorce, bought this townhouse, bought it move-in ready. Except I needed to start five projects, right? So you can start five projects and start doing all that stuff. And I got all those projects about 90% done. Well, hell, if you're 90% done, you're pretty much done, right? The first 90% of those projects took me about 3 months. The last 10% took me about 3 years, you know? Because I'm like that. That's good enough, right? We're almost there. If you're almost there, then you're there, right? I'm a just enough kind of alcoholic. So I tried all these things to fix my alcoholism. And I was powerless to do so. When I wound up, I was 3 years sober, living in Richmond, Virginia, thinking there better be something more. You know, my best observation after years and years of going to meeting was, come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We get sober together. We enjoy it. We talk about it. We enjoy it. We you know, pool parties and dances, and you know, we do all this fun stuff, which is all good and fun stuff. Trust me. There's two parts to AA: the program and the fellowship. But they're both parts of AA, and one without the other. The program without the fellowship doesn't work for me because I've done that, and the fellowship without the program doesn't work for me because I've done that too. But we do all this, and we stay sober as long as we can. And when your number comes up, your number comes up. Because that's what was happening to the people that I was hanging out with, you know. And when you go out, you go out. And if you're really, really lucky, then you make it back. That was my best observation. I was thinking, you got to have something more to offer than this. And not that anybody hadn't offered it to me. Not that I had not heard the solution stated in any meeting that I had been to in the previous 3 years. But for some reason, I was listening right then. And I went to a 5:30 Friday commuters meeting in Richmond that I went to on a regular basis, and there was a guy there that day who, to the best of my knowledge, never been to that meeting before, best of my knowledge, never been to that meeting since, but he was there that day, and he was talking about a solution, and there was something about his eyes, and he was an arrogant alcoholic. He was one of those, he called himself a recovered alcoholic. Yeah, one of those. He explained it to me later. He said, Dave, look, if you get shot by a bullet, okay, you're going to go to the hospital. You don't get killed. You're going to go to the hospital. The doctor's going to take the bullet out. He's going to stitch you up. And a couple of days later, he's going to come and declare you a recovered gunshot victim. But you are not bulletproof. And the next time you get shot, it's going to hurt, right? Okay, so recovered but not cured. Okay, got it, you know. And so I sidled up to this guy after the meeting, and I said, you know, I was thinking about brushing up on the steps a little bit. He said, oh, you want to do the steps? I guess you could say that. I'll warn you, if you ask one of these bleeding blue, you know, AA people to tell them you want to do the steps, they think you're serious. They think you mean it. He said, I want to do the steps. He said, meet me Saturday at this treatment center meeting and bring your big book. And we were just talking about this, sitting down at that picnic table, 3 years sober, open up the big book, which I had read three times before meeting him, never saw a word in it. There was a guy from my group named Braden. He moved to South Carolina a while ago. But Braden, in our meeting, would get up and say, I had to have a sponsor show me how to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, everybody else listening didn't know. I know Braden. He had 3 degrees, master's and PhDs in American literature. He'd literally been going to school for like 12 years to learn how to read. And he had to have a sponsor show him how to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? So I'm not smarter than him. It was funny. Tom Flynn calls me one day and goes, Dave, I started sponsoring somebody new. I said, really? He said, yeah, he's a rocket scientist up at Goddard. He said, so none of us can claim, you know, if you're smarter than a rocket scientist, even a rocket scientist can't get sober. So unless you're smarter than a rocket scientist, I guess you need this thing. I was like, yeah, you're right, Tom. So anyway, he sat down and we read that book, and I took the first step. 3 years sober, I took the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous, admitted to my innermost self completely, understanding what an alcoholic is. I have a phenomenon of craving, which we got a little cute ways of saying this, which means one is too many and a thousand is never enough. That's what that means. And I have a mental obsession, which means that I got something in my brain that will always take me back to booze. It always will, left to my own devices, right? And I've never wavered on that sense. I've never questioned that I am an alcoholic. That alone will not keep me sober, but I've never questioned whether I am. To me, the first step is not I'll never drink again. The first step is this. I'll never drink safely again. It was good once upon a time, then it wasn't, and it ain't ever going to be good again. I know what my fate is. I don't know how long I'll stay sober, but I know if I do get drunk again, I will not be down at Applebee's trading business cards and networking. That's not me. Sad and tragic things happen when I drink. Even to make it even worse, not headline worthy. I won't be on the news. I won't be on the front page of the paper. Just sad and tragic. You know, there's a line in the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. That's what the big book says. I've sat down with I don't know how many guys and gone through that book and come up on that. And I swear to God, regardless of education or non-education level or original language or social status or how much money they have in the bank, I've never had to explain that phrase to another alcoholic. We have pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now, you know what that is? They go, uh-huh. They may have never even seen the words before. They know what it means, right? That's what's in store for me. That's my first step. So anyway, we got to the end of how it works. At the end of how it works, there's these three things called the A, Bs, and Cs. And he says, do you believe that you're an alcoholic of the type described in this book? And I said, absolutely. He said, do you believe there's any human power that can relieve your alcoholism? Since I had been trying for 3 years to relieve my alcoholism and failed, I said, no. He said, do you believe that God can and will if you ask him to? And I told my sponsor my first lie. I said, yes. And I said, yes, because I've been around long enough to know that the right answer was yes. And I'm a people pleaser. What I really thought, all those years that I didn't think alcoholism was my problem, what I really thought was, if you took a knife and you cut me from my Adam's apple to my belly button and you opened me up, you'd find nothing inside but black, dead, dry rot. That there was nothing worth having, saving, rehabilitating, using. There's nothing useful in there. I've just gone too far. Gone too far, done too much, seen too much. I'm just damaged goods. And I'm not sure. See, I'm always holding my yardstick up to God. See? I limit God because I hold my yardstick up to him. And I figured I'd never take somebody like that, so why would he want to take me? But there was a little bit of hope. Just a little bit, you know? Maybe. So I said yes, and he saved me with the next question. He said, are you willing to follow through with the program of action as it's outlined in this book? And having absolutely no clue what I was in for, I said yes. And he sent me off to do my fourth step, and to this day, I have no idea why I did it. Because I was that belligerent guy, don't tell me what to do, you're not going to make an AA robot out of me, you know, I know better, who are you to tell me what to do and all this. And for once in my life, I just shut up and did it. And I can't even explain to you why, even today, but I did it. I did it, I guess, because I was done and because I was out of better ideas. And we did a fifth step. And I don't know about you, but I had a polite sponsor. When I was reading him my deepest, darkest, most intimate things in my life, he turned his head when he yawned. Yeah? How many times? You know? My sponsor, Tom, told me, he said, Dave, whatever you did, is there a word for it in the dictionary? And I said, yeah, Tom. He said, well, then you didn't do it first. As a matter of fact, so many people have done it, they had to make up a word for it. You're not very original. Okay. Something happened to me. Anyway, we did that, and I started doing nine-step amends, and I started running the road, going to meetings and kidnapping newcomers and doing all this stuff that we do, and something amazing happened. I woke up one day and realized that I hadn't thought about drinking in a long time. Not only had I not thought about drinking, I hadn't thought about not drinking in a long time. I just hadn't thought about it at all. It was gone. What I found out is when I practice the solution given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, the problem goes away. Because I have not done this thing perfectly, I have discovered also that when I stop practicing the solution, the problem comes back. And oh boy, does it come back, you know. I had a spiritual awakening. I didn't have an experience, but I had an awakening in my soul. It was like nothing changed and everything changed. I began to want to be me and to want to get up and let, and that had never happened to me before. I wanted your life. I wanted your girlfriend. I wanted your car. I wanted your job. I wanted anything but what I had. And I began to start to live my life and be present in my life. And man, it is a beautiful thing. A beautiful thing. Now, right about then, I graduated from school. I graduated with a civil engineering degree in 1992 during the recession. I couldn't buy myself a job. So I went overseas in the Peace Corps. I went to Ecuador, South America for 2 years and joined a group there, Grupo Siempre Unidos de Lata con Ecuador, no English speaking meetings. So I learned to speak Spanish. It's been a long time. Please don't quiz me afterwards. But I was a member of a group there, and we stayed sober together, and we kept each other sober, and we did a little bit of 12-step work. And I love those guys. You know, they'll forever be in my heart. And that's a really interesting story how that group came to be. I mean, AA down there was like AA in the 50s back here, you know, in the 90s, it was like that down there. So it was really interesting, a lot of public information and getting the message out there. And I had a great time, and I started to sponsor people. And I sponsored this one guy. He was so serious. He was 3 years sober. It's the first meeting I went to there, they have coffee afterwards. So we did the meeting, coffee afterwards, and they all want to know, you know, like, what are the meetings like, and do you have the same 12-step? I mean, they're just asking me questions, you know, and this guy's 56-year-old man looks at me and goes, will you listen to my fist up? And I said, you know, I don't speak very good English. And he said, I know. Will you listen to my fist up? So I said, okay, let's do it. And I'd get a Spanish big book, and I had a Spanish and English big book, because you never get to sponsor somebody. You got to know how to say the big words, you know, like anonymidad and, you know, and all that. And so we sat there, and we did the steps, you know. And this guy was serious. I mean, you know how we are when we get here. It was, like, serious. Like, if he had a smile, I think he'd have broken his face. I mean, he was serious. And we started doing all this, and he started doing amends. And then one day I was walking through, he was a taxi driver, and then one day I started walking through the plaza, and I was all up in my head about what was going on with the project and all this kind of stuff. And I hear somebody laughing, and I turn, and I look at the taxi stand, and it's him, and he's standing there with his taxi buddies, and his head's thrown back, and he's laughing, and he's free. And I got hooked like that. I got hooked, you know. When I help another alcoholic, I don't get people sober, I don't get people drunk, but what I do get is I get a seat on the 50-yard line to watch God happen to another human being. And I have never drank, smoked, or snorted anything that made me feel like that. That is a feeling that you cannot replace. There's a lot of heartache involved in it too, but man, what a high to watch God happen to another human being. And I came back to the United States, and boy meets girl on AA campus. And, you know, actually, I've only, since I did that, come really close to relapsing twice. And once was when I came back, I became so spiritual I was of no earthly good. I began to drink. That's why I need egotheflation. I became very important in my own mind. Just ask me, I would tell you. And I stopped going to meetings. And, you know, I still go to meetings, and I'll tell you why I still go to meetings, is I take my own little inventory of people that come back to AA. Mentally, I take my own little inventory, and just by my count, about 99 out of 100 of them, first thing they say, I stopped going to meetings, right? I stopped at one point, you know, and I started to work the steps backwards, and you certainly owed me an amends, you know, and then I started to pile up some resentments, you know. And I pretty much had a nervous breakdown. I was engaged to a girl that broke up. She handed the ring back, and I was about. And I wanted to drink. And when I say I admitted that I was an alcoholic, I didn't have any delusions about I'm going to have a couple one night, you know, and this is going to be okay. You know, I'm just talking about I was in so much pain, I didn't care. I knew it was going to be a disaster, and I didn't care. And I said a prayer because I had a two-hour drive. I said, God, please do not let this car stop. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200, because if I stop, I'm stopping at 7-Eleven. I'm getting a 12-pack. And I made it home, and I called my sponsor, and he didn't answer. And I called my spiritual advisor, and he didn't answer. And I called my brother, and he didn't answer. Oh, crap, what do you do now? One of the things that my sponsor had driven into me from day one was, when all else fails, work with another alcoholic. The week before, somebody had asked for volunteers to go into a jail meeting. This was on a Sunday. He was on a Monday, and I had gotten his card. And I called that guy up, and I said, let's go. I'm going. Let's go. Whoa, whoa, champ. I gotta get your social security number and clearance and all this kind of thing. I said, when are you going? He said, Monday. I said, who's going tonight? Like, I need to go. Anyway, I went down to a club that night, and that next day, I was in that jail meeting. And I took over that jail meeting, and I chaired it for about 3 years, and I handed it off to somebody that I sponsored. And those guys kept me sober. Those guys kept me sober and helped me through that event, helped me back into AA, back into the fold of AA, you know. Lack of power. I didn't realize, you know, when I stopped going to meetings, I didn't realize, because I was all, oh, it's steps, program. It is steps, and it is program, but what I didn't realize was, when I got all arrogant about my program's better than yours, when I stopped going to meetings, I had plugged that spiritual awakening, I had plugged into a power, and I realized when I separated myself from you, what I did was I kicked the plug out of the wall. I kicked the plug right out of the wall, and I disconnected myself from that source of power that I had found, that had transformed that life, and I found myself absolutely helpless and desperate. Now, then ups and downs, and I made it through that, and boy meets girl on AA campus, and we got married and had some kids. My son was born on my 8th anniversary, January 24th, 1997, and I love him dearly. He's 18 now. Lack of power, that is my dilemma. And explain that in a minute. And my daughter, both of whom are the light of my life. And anyway, that marriage lasted about 13 years, which is about 10 years longer than it should have. My ex-wife and I agree on that. We've had that conversation. We agree on that completely. but at one point, I had success in my career. I had a thriving home group that I was a member of. I sponsored a bunch of guys. I was running around speaking a lot. I had a single family home in a suburb, nice prestigious suburb in Northern Virginia, nice brick home. I had two kids, one boy, one girl. I had a minivan, I had a truck, and the light bulb didn't go off, and I didn't realize this until I wrote the guy the check, but I had a white picket fence around the yard. Yeah! I mean, like, I could put that poster on a wall, right? I mean, that's American dream, baby. And and then, of course, you know, one day it wasn't a sudden event, but one day my wife said, well, I want to get separated. And I'd known it was coming for a long time. And so it was kind of, my world got shaken up. Now, I can tell you that in all of my sobriety, people talk about taking their will back. And I was powerless. I'm powerless over this. And people talk about taking their will back, and to the best of my knowledge, in my sobriety, there's only been twice that I have, with full knowledge, withheld my will from God. Usually it comes in the form of, I say the prayer, I think I've given it all over, and it usually comes as, ouch, damn, that hurt. At work, it came when I was about 12 years sober at work, you know. I was a ramming powerhouse at work and bumping heads with everybody there. Why isn't it working? Why isn't it working? And then I realized, oh, huh. I didn't give this over. I didn't give this to God. I still got this. Sorry, God. Sorry. Here you go. You know, because I didn't realize it. Only twice, and this is what did I consciously, she said, I want to get separated, and I said, I got this. I didn't even ask. I knew exactly how I'm going to handle this. You know, the payment for that didn't really come until about 2 months ago. You know, my son turned 18 and pretty much said, I don't need you, I don't want you, and I don't want to have anything to do with you. And I haven't talked to him in several months, you know, and it's a divorce. He's mad over that, you know. I'm lucky it could have turned out worse than it did. But the story is that was my full intention was, God, I got to handle this one thing, okay? And then when we're through with this, you get the wheel back, right? Oh, y'all know it ain't that easy, is it? So got through that, fully intended to hand the wheel back, thinking I handed the wheel back, but really what happened was when I got through that, I was unhappy, and I fell into this little delusion that I fall into on a regular basis, which is, I'll be happy if. Right? And so I set out to recreate Dave in Dave's image. Right? If I get this at work and I accomplish this and I have this kind of girlfriend and I get in shape and I do these races and all this and I got just about everything that I set out to get. And where it got me was a year and a half later sitting on a rock on the Potomac River with the guy who was sponsoring me doing an inventory. Absolutely more disillusioned and more despair than I had ever been in during my divorce, you know. Nobody blame it on anymore. It's just me out there, you know. She ain't around anymore. It's mine, baby. Mine now. And that was depressing, you know. And so I had to start. I had to start the process of giving God back the wheel and giving back the will. Giving back to Him and getting back on board with what He wants instead of what I want, you know. Not fall into that delusion anymore. Now, and since then I've fallen in love and I truly have met my soulmate and I love her dearly. And I think more of her than any other human being walking the face of this earth. And she's good for my family and she's good for my children. And she's just good, good, good all around. And I am happier now than I ever have been, you know. And one of my favorite prayers is, God, I want what you want for me more than what I want for me. Because I have a severe case of alcoholic ADD. I am easily distracted by bright and shiny objects, you know. Yeah, it's all God in service. Ooh, look at that. You know, God said, "Ooh, wow, what's that?" You know, God, I want what you want for me more than what I want for me. You know, I could tell you many, many stories about that, but we're out of time, and I do want to tell you about one more thing, and that is that when my sponsor and I did those steps, and I got to the A's and C's, and he asked me if I lied to him. I said I thought God can and will if I ask Him to, and I didn't really think so. I found out that all I had to do was give God a shot. That's all I had to do. And God showed up in spades, you know. It's easier now that I have kids, you know. My kids, and I love my son more than my own life, and I always will, no matter what he does, or no matter whether he wants to be a part with me or not, and my daughter too, you know. I realize that my kids, they're their own people. They will make mistakes. They will make decisions. They will hurt my feelings. They will frustrate me. They are also the source of my greatest joy. They will do all these things, but they could never, ever, ever, ever do anything to make me love them less. They might sadden me. They might frustrate me. They might do all these things, but I will never love them less than the day I loved them, that they hit this world, you know. If we're all God, God doesn't have any grandkids. We're all God's kids, see? And it just doesn't make sense to me that I could be that kind of dad and I could love my kids unconditionally and that there's an all-powerful God who's my father who couldn't. That doesn't make sense to me. You know, if I can do it that way, certainly God can love me the same way. What if I've been running around trying to earn something that is given freely and completely, you know? I love my friend Bill M. always says, God doesn't care whether I'm drunk or sober. God just cares. Period. Right? You know? All I had to do was give God a shot, and He showed up in spades, you know. And God happens here. And He can happen to you too, but all I had to do was set aside my own ideals. The big book says that we believe God wants us to be happy, and I truly, truly, truly believe that all God really wants is for me to be happy, you know. The trick to that is I haven't always been happy, right? So God is not the sum total of the equation. I am part of that equation too. All I have to do is let go. I'm going to tell this story because I love this story. I'm going to take up a couple more minutes of your time and tell this. There were a bunch of creatures that lived at the bottom of a river. They were river dwellers. And there was a strong current in the river, and these creatures were taught from birth that they should always cling to the rocks, because if you didn't cling to the rocks, the current of the river would take you and it would destroy you and it would smash you against the rocks. And so all these creatures, their entire lives, clung to the rocks. But one of these creatures looked up and he saw all the wonderful things in the river, all the fish and the lights and the flowers and all the stuff up there. And he said, God, there's got to be more to life than clinging to this rock. And the other said, don't do it. Don't do it. You'll get smashed. You'll die if you let go of the rock. And one day he just couldn't stand it anymore, and he got a wild idea, and he let go of the rock. And what they told him was going to happen, it did happen. The current picked him up, and it smashed him against the rocks, and it beat him, and it battered him, and he was bruised. But eventually, what happened was the current picked him up, and all of a sudden he was off the bottom, and he was floating down the river with all the beautiful things, and he was a part of them, and he was a part of the beauty of the entire river. And all the other creatures, the bottom creatures that were on the bottom of the river, would look up. And then we'd go, look, it's a miracle. And he would look down at him and go, I'm no miracle. I'm just like you. I just let go. Thanks for letting me share.